Well, welcome, Kevin. Thank you so much for taking time to do this today.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm happy to do it. Absolutely.
Well, it's very much appreciated. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your career at Kalmbach Publishing?
Well, I had two stints there, one long one and one short one. I first worked there in 1974, just a year out of college, for a couple of years in the sales department. I was writing ad copy for Trains, Model Railroader. Those were the two magazines we published then, and the books. So it was all railroads all the time. And I did that for 2 years, and then I got the bug to go back to my previous career, which was newspapers, which I had only done a year out of college. So I got a chance to go back to newspapering in Michigan. So I went back and worked at three newspapers over the next several years in Michigan before we moved back to Milwaukee in 1980. And then in 87, I got a call from Dave Ingalls, who was the newly installed editor of Trains. He was the managing editor. He got promoted. And he was interested in having me apply for this opening at Trains. So I did. And I got the job. So from 1987 until I retired in 2016, I was on the payroll at Kalmbach. That was 29 years, I believe. So total service was 31 years, but 29 the second time. And so I worked for Trains for 13 years, directly as an editor, and later editor-in-chief. And then the next 16 years after that, I got into management.
And what would you say the company culture was like?
Well, it didn't change all that much, except that it changed in scale. When I first came to Kalmbach in 74, there was an entire older generation of people that were still there, people whose names who are involved in the center will certainly recognize, Dave Morgan and Gil Reed and George Gloff, Lynn Westcott. That was the early generation. There was really the first generation of people that Al Kalmbach brought along after World War II. They were still there, so the company was pretty folksy. Everybody knew each other. I think there were only about 50 employees, 60 employees. When I came back in 87, the company had expanded greatly. We'd acquired some magazines that were way outside the railroad field. The book line had grown a lot. So it was an entirely different company, and by that time there were 150 employees, if not more. By the time I left in 2016, I think our payroll was over 200. So it was with 200 people, you end up having a somewhat different corporate culture. There was a lot more attention paid to classic ideas about what management should be doing and how to make a pleasant, equitable workplace and all that kind of stuff. None of that was happening in 1974. But after 1987, it was probably a lot like working at other companies, except that it was, as it always claimed to be, a very friendly place to work. The president of the company, there were three of them that I worked under during that second term here. They were all approachable people. Anybody could walk up to and ask them about anything and stop by their office if need be. It was a very informal, casual place, so long as people remembered what they were there for and what their responsibilities were. But we were also caught up in some huge changes externally that we had to adjust to. You know, the arrival of the internet, changes in printing technology, changes in the way we did business with our contributors, our writers and photographers. And that just kept on changing, you know, especially after 2000. It just accelerated. Mm-hmm. So that led the company, after I'd retired, that's one of the reasons they ended up changing their name to Kalmbach Media from Kalmbach Publishing, because they wanted to reflect this move beyond just printing technology and printing content.
Was the art a big part of everyday discussions?
Not as much as it used to be, because by the time I came back in 1987, the company was pretty much finished with publishing large-scale, thoroughly researched, rather expensive to produce hardcover books. And as we know from the paintings in the center's collection, a lot of the paintings were done for book covers. Well, by the late 1980s, we weren't publishing books like that anymore. Same is true of the magazine. Back in the 50s and 60s, Dave Morgan and other editors of Trains and Model Railroad, especially of Trains, often turned to art to kind of beef up what we were doing in the magazine visually, especially if color printing was involved, because paintings in those days always translated to printing a little more effectively than color photographs did. By the time I got there, only two or three times a year were we commissioning the kind of paintings and art that we see in the center's collection. Now, we were doing all kinds of other stuff with the art department, constantly developing maps, highly accurate and detailed maps, track plans for the model railroad crowd, certain specialty graphics for certain kinds of stories, that kind of thing. But the original fine art was had tailed off considerably by then. That was mainly a function of the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, as you can see from the dates that accompany all these various paintings.
Did your interest in train art start when you started working with Kalmbach, or did that happen before then?
I was certainly aware of railroad art long before I came to Kalmbach because I began reading Trains magazine in 1965 when I was 14. And very early on, I realized that there were a handful of artists whose name became familiar over time that were doing this kind of thing. In fact, even before I read Trains in 1965, a few years leading up to that, I began running into Kalmbach books in the public library in the small town I grew up in. So I knew about Gill's painting for the Inner Urban Era book, which we do not have in the collection, or George Gloff's painting for The Time of the Trolley, which we do have in the collection. So as a teenager and as a guy in college, yeah, I was very much aware of the art. And by that time, too, people like Gil Reed and others were beginning to expand into selling art prints of their various art. And then historically speaking, of course, I was very aware of the earlier generation of artists back in the 40s and 50s who did original art for the railroad companies. And a lot of that stuff was incredible. And they were amazingly talented artists. And some of those paintings are they're in museums now, and they're worth a lot of money.
I had the opportunity to talk to one of the artists in the collection, John Swatsley,
Yes.
and he talked about his interaction with you about a specific painting for a 2000 cover for the Casey Jones Revisiting, because initially he had painted an original cover 30 years prior,
I'd
is
forgotten
my
that.
understanding,
Yeah.
and that you were the one that reached out and said, "Hey, 30 years ago you painted a painting about Casey Jones, let's revisit it." Do you
Well,
remember that?
I didn't remember the earlier Casey Jones painting, but I'd always been a fan of Swatsley. I don't know why. I guess it's just the way I'm wired when it comes to encountering art. But in the 70s, as a Trains reader, I began encountering these occasional pieces of art that John would do to accompany certain stories in Trains. And I loved his style because it was kind of a rough, impressionistic, looser version that was, to me, more modern, more contemporary, more interesting, and yet he paid very close attention to the dimensions and the perspective of what the railroad looks like. So he wasn't completely off the charts in terms of abstraction, but his style was a little looser, and I loved it. So years later, I remembered him, and we came upon this, what do you call it, this anniversary of the Casey Jones wreck in 1900. Looking ahead, a few months ahead of then, we could see that we wanted to do a story on Casey. We needed to do something on Casey Jones because it's such a mythical story in American history. So I knew the anniversary was coming up, and I asked one of my favorite writers, Peter Hansen, if he'd be interested in doing a story on Casey Jones. And of course, the Casey Jones story had been told time and time again in books and magazines and then probably in movies and TV in one form or another. It was an old story. In fact, I even had a couple of good friends that were regular contributors to Trains that said, "Do you really want to do Casey Jones? Hasn't that been done to death?" But I thought Peter could do the kind of historical research and practice the sort of interesting historical journalism, and he's a hell of a writer too. He could transform that story into something fresh. So we set him loose for a few months. This is probably actually more like a year before the issue came out. He did a lot of wonderful research. And he did a fantastic story on revisiting the whole story of Casey Jones, why the train crashed, how we should view Jones as a hero or not in American history, how to illustrate it in the cover. Well, there's very few photographs of Jones and only a couple of photographs of the locomotive that he had, and they weren't appropriate for the cover. So naturally, I thought, well, maybe this is one of those rare times we should commission some art for the cover. For some reason, Swatsley's style from 20 years before hit me as being the perfect solution. So I must have tracked John down through some search engine that's not around anymore to find out where he was, and I found out that he was a prominent, highly regarded, internationally known painter of wildlife, and frequently went to Africa to do his research. And he was living in New England, I believe. So I just cold called him or emailed him or whatever and tracked him down and said, "Hey, you used to work at Kambach and you certainly had an idea of how to paint trains and make them look like trains. Would you be interested?" He went for it. He went for the pitch. He was great. And he charged us real money, but he charged us, I'm guessing, a third or 25% of what he normally got. I could not have afforded his normal fee. I'll just say what it was. I could not have afforded $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 out of the train's editorial budget. But he did it for $1,000, God bless him. And I could scrape up $1,000. So we paid him $1,000 for the painting, and it was enough for him to just let us keep the painting, so it's now part of the collection. And he did a fantastic job. He was an artist who also knew how to be a commercial artist. So he painted it in a way that worked perfectly on the cover, with the cover blurbs, the cover logo, and everything else. But it was also a very faithful rendition of that locomotive. And it's very much in the Swastley style. So that was a fun project. But it's one of the only times I was ever involved in any kind of commissioning of artists, because that day had largely passed.
Now, when he was talking to me about this piece, he said specifically, Kevin said, I want color.
Oh, yeah.
And so he said, I tried to give him as many colors as I
He did.
possibly can.
He did a fantastic job with
He
it
did.
because it happened in the middle of the night. I think it happened at 3 in the morning in rural Mississippi. And I don't know what the weather was like. I doubt if the moon was out. So he had to take some license with it. But he did a great job. He made the most of the glow from the firebox and the headlight. And he exaggerated that glow a little bit, so some of that orange light covers, washes over the entire locomotive, and the sky is lighter certainly than it would have been. I mean, one reason the train crashed is because it was pitch black that night, and you couldn't see anything. So that was a fantastic bit of work on his part, but it's why I just knew it would be this good, because he was that good before. I think he was one of the most talented artists the company ever had in its employ, but he clearly was ambitious and wanted to move beyond just doing stuff for the Kambach magazine. Plus, he was a cool guy, from what I could tell. And I can't remember where he went to school, but his art credentials,
Oh, LA.
his academic credentials were terrific.